You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
American voice then.
American voice on the Oceanic Zoom, eh? All right. Yeah. Kia ora, gang. I'm your boy, Zach Huff, and I'm here with the very esteemed, very, very talented Mr. Bill Bailey. Good morning to you, Bill. How are we? Are we in the country?
Yes, I am. Good morning. And I am in the country. I've been here a few days now. And I'm a little bit under the weather. Sorry, my voice is a bit croaky because I picked up some sort of bug. I don't know what it is, but and I'm on the mend now, so I'm all good. So, you know, keep rocking.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad to hear. I'm also coming down with something. There's been a bit of a disease floating around the city, unfortunately. I want to start off by talking about your honorary membership on the Society of Crematorium Organists. Have you met up with that crowd? Like, what are they like?
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I've only met one or two of them. It was obviously a great honor, you know, I'd mentioned this, the fact that I'd played the organ in a crematorium, and I'd stepped in when somebody was feeling a bit ill and they needed an organist. And so somehow got this leaked out. I mentioned it in an interview or something, or in a podcast. And the next minute I got a letter, an embossed letter from the Society of Crypto. You are now an honorary member. I was like, wow. So I haven't actually exercised the right. I think it means that I can just rock up to any funeral and just go, excuse me, and just hold up the letter and just say, I'm taking over, and just sort of like, you know, commandeer someone's funeral and start playing, like, you know, but it was all jazz riffs or whatever. So I haven't actually used that right yet, but I mean, yeah, it's a great honor. It's a great organization to be part of.
Maybe when musical comedy, maybe when you kind of run out of ideas for that, you could take over and that could be your main career, you know.
That'd be my main gig, yeah. Just playing, just crashing people's funerals.
Well, speaking of instruments, you're currently learning the ancient Swedish nickel harpa, which looks like a violin on steroids. How are you getting on with that?
Yeah, I got to say, it's a lot trickier than I thought. It's quite a difficult thing to master. It's a beautiful instrument. I mean, it's got a lower range than a violin, so it's kind of somewhere down, almost like a violin or a cello range. And instead of, you know, pressing the strings, you use little wooden keys to bend the string into the pitch that you want. And that bit of it is quite, I mean, it's old tech. I mean, this has been around since the 1500s. But what's difficult is how you actually hold it. You know, like, how do you get the bow around it? I mean, it's so odd and strange. And so that bit of it, I think I've finally cracked. And that is now I kind of clamp it in a drum stand. It's a stand. I've sort of adapted it from a snare drum stand, and I placed the nickel harpa in it, so you can actually kind of approach it, get round it, and then bow it. Because when I started bowing it, I was bowing down the way, because I had it kind of like a bit like the Ramones, you know. I had it sort of low slung, and I was bowing down the way. And I did a little video of it. Oh my God, the nickel harpa community, they went crazy. How could you, how dare you bow it this way? It was like this sort of, you know, this is an abomination. So I've had to try and figure out a way to play, but I'm getting there. I'm getting there with it. You know, it's a lot harder than I thought. It's harder than the bagpipes, and the bagpipes were hard. So it's a challenge.
Oh man, do you have someone who like sources these exotic instruments for you to learn? Like, how do you keep scouring and finding niche instruments like the nickel harpa, like the Turkish saz?
Do you know what happens? People give them to me. That's what happens. I just get donated these instruments because people know that that's the kind of thing that I collect, and so people don't know. They just give them to me, donate them. And these are friends, neighbors, other musicians, fans. Leave these instruments for me, sometimes at gigs, sometimes they just arrive. Over the years, I've been given dozens of these instruments. You know, a guy came up all the way from the train from the west of England with a hang drum. You know, he just came and just stood outside my house. He said, I got this, and just handed me this thing and then went away. I've had lutes given to me, sazes, accordions, drums, all kinds of guitars, strange theremins made out of... I had a theremin that was made out of a garden gnome given to me. I mean, it just... there's a whole range of these things, and I've got them all, so I can't really take them all out at the same time, but some of them are like, you know, I just think, all right, okay, this now, yeah, you're up. It's like, you know, you've been on the subs bench for a while, step up, you know, you're on. That's usually how I get these instruments. I go to sort of music shops a lot, but that's very much to get traditional instruments, you know, things that are replacements, things like guitars and mandolins and mandolas. But some of these other things are so unique. I don't think I haven't seen anything like them anywhere else.
Mm.
So they're all part of the show.
When you're playing and devising a new musical show, do you take instruments that you haven't mastered yet, or are you only bringing on instruments that you feel very confident with?
Oh, no, it's a combination of two, really. It's a mixture. I always like to try and challenge myself, you know, and try and sort of go right out of my comfort zone and take an instrument that I'm still learning and see what happens and see what the audience reaction is and see what performance does when you're playing an instrument. Because often, you know, performance adds another load of... There's other things happen, like adrenaline and the kind of energy of a performance, where something else happens when you play instruments with people, that things that you don't expect. And that's kind of why I love it. I love the unknown element of it. And I combine that with instruments that I've been playing in my shows for years, you know, like the piano, something I learned on, that was my very first instrument, and the guitar, the kind of acoustic and the electric guitars, which I've sort of played for years. So those things are almost kind of like the core instruments, which I always take with me, plus some sort of percussive instrument. There's always that element to it. And then there's all kinds of other things, you know, bits of tech, bits of, you know, samples. I use a lot of looping samples and MIDI, and, you know, combine that with visuals as well. So there's a sort of tech element to the show, as well as this, which I kind of quite like. I like the sort of, you know, the modern element to it, plus, you know, you're playing medieval instruments that perhaps people haven't seen before.
Mm, it's awesome. You've said about this new show, Vaudevillain, which you're touring Aotearoa with. It's kind of based on a moment of clarity where you realized exactly the kind of entertainer you are, and that is a sort of modern vaudeville act. Now, vaudeville is an old variety show, theatrical style, dating back to the 1860s. It's pretty family-friendly, it's camp, has a broad church audience. When was that moment of clarity for you? Was there anything particularly remarkable about it, or did it just sort of click?
I think it was the end of the show, my West End show. I was doing a show in London, and I was doing a whole run of shows, and you know, I think I might have read somewhere like a comment about it or a review or something, and it said it was like, it's just like a modern vaudeville or vaudeville reinterpreted for the modern audience. So I just thought, yeah, that's it. That's exactly what this is. And then it led me to kind of, I was kind of immersed in that world, but being in a theatre in the West End, you can't help but be aware of the history of the place. Like, as you go up to the dressing room, there's all these old posters from shows going back, you know, hundreds of years. And so you know, I was sort of really kind of like, it got me thinking about the whole history of what I do and the history of cabaret and musical performance, which is very much what I do. And I suppose that kind of struck a chord. And also a couple of things where, you know, again, these are, you know, people, I suppose, observations that people had remarked on and saying it was very much like, you know, with Bill, it's like you can't really describe what he does, because it's not straightforward stand-up. It's not a music gig. There's a combination between the two. And I think vaudeville really is the perfect description of it. And I find it's weird after all these years, you know, touring around the world, and oh yeah, you know, finally this is a moment of clarity, this moment of realization. And it's actually great. I love it. It was almost like a relief and almost a sense of finally being able to describe what it is that I do. And that is, I can't tell you what a profound moment that was, when you realize, well, that's what it is. It's almost like that's what I'm here to do. That's my role in life, my purpose.
Your raison d'etre, as the French like to say. Yeah. Since realizing that you're a sort of torchbearer of vaudeville, have you delved deep into its history for inspiration for this new show, Vaudeville?
Yeah, I have actually done quite a lot of research on it and a lot of reading around it. And it's a fascinating subject, you know. The name itself comes from a French town, Vaudeville, in Normandy, which was where, and it began in the 1400s. I mean, that's how old it is. And it started out with a guy called Olivier Basselin, who was a textile worker. And he wrote these kind of bawdy tavern songs, just sing along kind of, you know, songs for the making fun of the local mayor or dignitaries, and he'd sing them in the tavern, and everyone would like bang, you know, the drink along. And I just thought, but that's exactly how I started, you know, singing songs like that in little cabaret shows in London when I started out. And then it became hugely popular. So I guess the thing which really struck me about it was that I didn't quite realize, and that was the big change with vaudeville when it became hugely popular in America, was that it broadened the audience. I think that's the thing which struck a chord with me, was that prior to that, it had been in small taverns, cabarets. It spread throughout France and then through Europe, and then it went to America, where it was hugely popular. And then around about the 1850s or 1860s, there was a big market change in the kind of approach of vaudeville shows. And it wasn't very much like it was used to be, quite sort of late night, boozy kind of shows. And then somebody realized, hang on, we should make this, broaden this out to all ages. And that way we can do more shows. We can do matinee shows. We can do earlier shows, get more audience in. And then I realized, well, that's it. That's exactly one of the features of my audience, is that nobody can quite pin down the demographic. They seem to be from all ages and all backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's a sort of, I find this link to the past with the show. So, and also it started to decline with the arrival of radio. People just sit at home, turn the radio on, and didn't have to go out to the show. Mm-hmm. And that was 100 years ago. So it's a kind of it's also that sense of like about, it's 100 years on from when the thing started to sort of fall into decline. And yet now we've got a thriving audience. We've got people wanting to go and see live performance. And I feel that there's a brilliant sort of sense of, I don't know, maybe sort of full circle here, of people realizing that while we can stay at home and get all the entertainment and food and delivery and anything you want, actually what we really want more than ever in these disconnected, strange times is to share a live experience, something you can't replicate anywhere else.
For sure. That's interesting that there's kind of a history mirroring itself there. That's really fascinating. Yeah. You're an animal lover and a conservationist. You're an admirer of the broader natural world. You're embarking on a 13-day tour across our country, which has a lot of natural beauty hotspots. What parts of the country are you looking forward to seeing when it comes to pretty pristine environments?
I'm very much, I mean, I love going out walking, particularly in the South Island, just going out on bush tracks, taking my binoculars, trying to see as many birds as I can. You know, I mean, it's one of the great joys as a birder coming to New Zealand is the sort of preponderance of birds, particularly birds that you can't see anywhere else. I mean, they're just unique to New Zealand. So that part of it is something I always look forward to. Any chance I get, I'll be out.
Well, in Pōneke, I can definitely recommend Zealandia, and in Otipoti, Dunedin, I can recommend the Orokonui Eco Sanctuary. Thank you so much, okay. Bill. I really appreciate it. Do you have any final words or words of wisdom for our lovely audience?
Just come down. Come down and don't be shy to join in.
That was a Radio 1 91FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.